listening to the Albion Roar in association with oldfootballshirts.com on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on our podcast on Audio Boom, on just about every single platform there is. My name's Alan Wares, and as we approach the end of this first season in the Premier League, I'm delighted to say that we're actually putting the clock back a few years. Two of the Albion's great centre-back stalwarts have joined me in the studio here in Kemp Town. Welcome back to Guy Butters. Hello, Guy. How are you? I'm fine, mate. I'm fine. And for the first time, after 5 years of asking, and let's put it this way, no one, I don't think, can ever get away with 5 years of nagging and not know about it. But finally, he's decided to relent. Welcome to the Albion Roar, Danny Cullip. How are you, mate?
I'm very well. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
How many times did you do that?
25.
I think it was that. And what was the first 24 answers?
I'll get back to you.
Exactly. Gentlemen, welcome to the Roar. Danny, let's start with you as the Roar virgin. You started off life as a footballer at Oxford United. And just before we started recording, you let me know that even now, from where you were back in the mid-90s at Oxford United to where we are now, there are some dot-to-dots. So tell us about your early time at Oxford.
Yeah, well, Oxford United was my first club. I went there as an apprentice, so a YTS back in the day. Spent 2 years as a YTS and worked under the ex-England manager, Steve McLaren. He's my youth team manager. I was lucky enough actually to play alongside him in a few reserve games, which was quite good. Our local derby was against Swindon Town, and the opposition manager was a guy called John Trollope.
Who played forever for Swindon. He's a hero down there, isn't he?
He was, and he's a very, very good coach. You really knew you was playing against his sides because he was very vocal on the touchline, and maybe that rubbed off on me after playing against him so many times.
Yeah, who knew? It comes from somewhere. So, I mean, tell us about did you have many dealings with John? Was he someone who's always in the background at the opposition?
Yeah, it was a big derby down for Oxford against Swindon. Mm. I was in digs with a couple of lads that were from the Swindon area as well, so there were six of us in digs. So when we used to play against Swindon Town, which obviously was a local derby, it was always a big game for us, like as any derby is. But John was very much on the touchline, eager to egg his team on. You take note of them sort of things. You try to pick things up all the way through your career. That's just one thing I remember about him. He was a very, very good coach. I remember I played alongside his son Paul, who's now a coach at the Albion, mm-hmm. At Fulham. I remember saying to Paul about his dad. They've got a lot of football in the family.
Absolutely. I mean, we'll come to your Fulham stuff in a minute. But from Oxford, you made it to a professional, but you didn't actually manage to make your league debut there.
No, well, I was young pro at the time. I got a 1 year contract. So I'd had an injury the season before, so I kind of had to come back. I think Dennis Smith, another hard as nails centre half, he was back in the day. He was the manager of Oxford's first team, and funnily enough, Guy come on loan there as a player. So. Which was interesting seeing him back.
So there's
in the
an
day.
Awful lot of crisscrossing of career paths for you two here,
but,
isn't there?
Yeah, but at the time I had a guy called Matty Elliott and Phil Gilchrist. Obviously, them two went on to be magnificent for Oxford, mm-hmm. but also they both went to Leicester.
I was about to say Elliott went to Leicester, didn't
he? And Matt did as well.
Okay.
And West Brom as well, I think. Matt Gilly went to West Brom as well. So they had, it was very hard as a young player trying to break in past them two.
Sure. So. In that case, bearing in mind that all sort of like the things that effectively working against you, there's a chap called Mickey Adams sort of like the look of you. Did he like the look of you, or were you kind of recommended by Dennis Smith? How did that work?
Anyone that knows Mick knows the hard work that he did behind the scenes going to games, whether that's youth team, reserve games, non-league games. I went on a couple of times to non-league. When I was at Oxford, I went to Kettering Town, who were in the conference at the time and managed by a Gary Johnson. So I went on loan there as a young guy, playing in the conference, playing regularly.
Down for the Poppies.
Yeah. Yep. And they were a really good side at the time at Rockingham Road. It was a fantastic time. Really, really gained a lot of experience.
They got to the FA Cup a few times, didn't they? First round and second round.
They were a big non-league club back then. They had a guy, an ex-Newcastle director behind the scenes, putting the money in. And Gary,
that's not a good thing these days, is it?
No.
You consider that.
No, but I mean,
Newcastle directors.
But Gary, you could tell that he had football running through his veins as well. His whole family and his son Lee used to come and train, who used to be on Arsenal's books as a kid. And, you know, that was kind of where I got the taste for real, real first-team football. And Mickey would have come and watched me in them games. And it was basically the end of my year as a first-year pro at Oxford. Mm-hmm. I went on trial at Shrewsbury at the end of the season. And they offered me a contract. Kettering offered me a contract. And then Mickey come in. And obviously, I didn't know him at the time, but you know, you get to know.
But when someone says Fulham, you think, well, even if they were in the fourth, they were in the fourth division at the time, weren't they?
But well, but my dad's a Fulham fan,
right?
And you know,
and there's a history of that.
Of course,
I mean,
there is.
With all due respect to Kettering, that they don't have.
Well, Mickey's words were, "What do you go? What do you want to play for me, or go with one man and his dog up the road, or be at Fulham?" Because you know, at the time, Fulham offered me half the amount of money that Kettering Town did, and as a young kid, you know. Double the money,
absolutely.
But it's not what I play football for.
No.
I wanted to play, so it was.
Does location help? I mean, because you're allowed from Bracknell, aren't you?
Yeah.
In Berkshire, not far from Reading. I mean, so I suppose being fairly near to home, so young, probably is quite appealing as well, isn't it?
Well, not. It didn't really. I was quite single-minded, motivated. I lived away from home for the first 2 years, so from 16 to 18, anyway, in Diggs.
Right.
So moving around, and anyone that's seen my career know I've moved around a little bit, so I quite like a little move.
Yeah.
So no, it wasn't really a factor being local. It was more a factor after you spoke to Mick and explained what they were trying to do at Fulham, and my dad being a Fulham fan and the history behind Fulham.
Yeah.
It was a no-brainer, to be honest.
So before we start talking about Danny's Fulham career, Guy, if you're saying that your paths crossed at Oxford, what do you remember about the teenage Danny Culleb?
To be honest, I think I only played three games. I don't think I was there that long.
Right, but you remember him though, didn't you?
To be fair,
I might have been a youth team player when you first came.
I remember playing a reserve game there because I think they had a cup game or something like that.
Yeah.
So I couldn't play. I didn't want to get cup tied. So we played Arsenal away, and I'm not sure if you might have even played because it was a young
Spurs
lads.
Player didn't want to play for to play against Arsenal.
It was at Highbury as well. It was beautiful. I remember.
Was that Ian Wright played in that game?
There was a lad up front played, and I've played the ball, and he's caught me late, and I literally he sort of fell over me as he went as well, and he caught me late.
Mm.
And I remember just screaming at him on the floor, like the old Arsenal.
Please don't swear.
Nah, the Arsenal Tottenham. I mean, there weren't that many people watching,
right?
But I remember the old thing come up, you know, the Arsenal rivalry, and I sort of give him something on the floor really loud, and I think because hardly anyone there echoed all around the ground. But there was a few young lads to play. But like I say, I think I only played about three games then, and before I got called back to Portsmouth.
Sure.
It's when you look back on it that you realise, because obviously I was a young lad, and the reason I would have knew a guy because.
Yeah.
He was coming into the position I thought I should have had.
Right.
Because you're a cocky 17, 18-year-old, and he's coming in, obviously, as a senior pro, older than me. So that's why he wouldn't really have known about me, but I knew about him because he was the one coming into my
What's this old
so-called
large
position.
Fella doing? Yeah,
yeah.
So many bickering you have nowadays is a well-rehearsed set of grievances, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, he did.
Do you remember that time at Oxford win?
Yeah. But then again, on our debut together, Guy ironed me out, to be fair, when I was going for an header.
Oh, do tell.
Yeah. Well,
no, Sheffield, wasn't it?
I thought it was Stoke.
Come on, Statler and Waldorf, give us the details.
I just remember going up for an header and then Guy coming through and me ending up on the floor and him winning the header as usual and me and the striker on the floor.
I'm sort of carrying the bumps on my head and that.
Yeah. You probably didn't even notice it, did you?
No.
I doubt it. Not on my looks. No, you're just sort of another one. There you go. But great, like Danny said, great team playing alongside Matt Elliott. You know, you could tell he was going to go play a higher level. I think it was sort of the old third division, whatever you call it then. So
if we're talking mid-90s, Oxford were kind of in the way down, but in the mid-80s they were
very
a decent
team.
Yeah, they won the league
team.
Cup. And,
yeah. This would have been early 90s, probably 93, 94.
Houghton would have gone. Aldridge would have gone. They had some, you know.
Yeah, Jimmy Jilton still there,
right?
Yeah, Jim.
They always used to be Brighton as well.
They used to fed
me up as well.
Yeah.
That was awful.
Joey Beecham, Chrissy Allen, Les Robinson.
Yeah. So no rubbish there.
No. Good side.
So the fact that you're actually kind of noted for your combative style, especially at the Albion, and screaming, you're talking about sort of echoing across an empty sort of stadium with the scream of "Let's have a winner." Where did that combative style for you? You're talking about sort of hard men, but is it something that, for instance, Mickey Adams really decided to bring out? And you're saying, you know, look, if you're going to do it, go for it. I mean, I'm talking about when he was at Fulham.
Well, mine would have been as I was growing up. I mean, my dad's one of 13 kids. You know, 9 boys, 4 girls, South London.
Right.
You know, bless her, my nan is dead now. She had to bring all the... My granddad died young, so she had to bring all the kids up on her own.
Yeah.
And I used to go and watch all my uncles, because one of my uncles was on Spurs books as a kid, but when they moved out of London, they didn't have the money to be able to go back and carry on playing. So we went to Aldershot Town, and he used to play with Gary Peters, the ex-Reading manager, Preston manager.
Yeah.
And a few of my uncles were very good at football. Not so much my dad, but, you know, my uncle. So I used to go and watch them play. They had a family business, and all my uncles and that used to play on a Saturday, so I used to go and watch it. And I used to, yeah, that's where I've really got the combative for watching the, right. the men's football from
Crash
a young age.
And stuff.
The, yeah, exactly.
So the Premier League was never going to be for you, was it? You know, all that sort of beautiful carpet. No, never mind. So,
you've still got to defend in the Premier League.
Absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely. So tell us about your time at Fulham. Did you have a good time there?
I had a fantastic time there. I made my league debut there. 1-0 win at home to Hereford. Mm-hmm. Funny story, actually, because as any centre-half, tried to make it as uncomfortable, shall we say, for the strikers as possible. And I remember going home after that game, and like pro footballer, I took my then-girlfriend, who's my wife now, out for a Harvester on the way into town for a few beers.
Cool, you know what
you
do. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly,
what
steak dinner. Big money, yeah. Steak dinner.
Casanova's got nothing on you.
So I was at the bar, I remember being at the bar, funnily enough, and all these football fans come in because it was like Bracknell, and it's the road the Harvester was on is it's a furrow through for the M3 to the M4 basically.
Yeah, another one. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so the Bagshot Road and everything else, and obviously we just played Hereford, and I kind of think they would have gone back on the M4 somewhere to get back home, and they had this kind of West Country accent, and they're all in their white, and I think, and there was a couple of guys were staring at me at the bar, and I'm thinking, oh, maybe these might be Hereford fans here.
Yeah.
And they weren't. They ended up being Bristol fans.
Ah.
So, yeah.
So you
same,
saw
kind
shirt.
Of same neck of the woods, but yeah. I was kind of tensed up waiting for a little bit of argy-bargy, but no, it never happened.
So this would have been the season, because you said, I've got my notes, you made your debut in 96 for Fulham. So would this have been the season that Brighton were, you know, sort of, that effectively Hereford went down? Was it that season, or because I think was that the Wigan won the division
by default? Because you do know why they won, don't you?
Because of the goal scored.
Yeah, the only season they did the goal scored, and our bless him, chairman at the time, Jimmy Hill, was on the board that changed it. Because I've got a medal indoors. Yeah. That's actually a second place medal that's got the Wigan colours on it.
Oh,
because we would have won it. On goal difference.
For those that are not watching in Super Reverb vision, the fury in Danny Cullip's eyes as he was telling me that. But I would say this, it saved the Albion from going down because Hereford had a better goal difference than us.
Gotcha.
And we'd scored more goals. So.
Oh, well, I don't mind now then, I'll know that.
All right, so you've kept this grudge for 20 years.
No, I'm fine.
Oh, guys, just shaking his head, going, "Oh my God, what have I done here?" So that first season. I mean, obviously, you know, you didn't know at the time that you were going to eventually be playing for Brighton. But did you sort of have an awareness or a realization as to what was going on at the club back in those times?
I didn't. To be honest with you, I remember playing at Brighton. Mm-hmm. Actually,
so you played at the Goldstone.
Yeah, I played at the Goldstone. Yeah, and it was a great place. Uh-huh. Great place. Atmosphere was fantastic. But I didn't really know too much about what was going on at the time because we was. That season we was too focused on the promotion.
Absolutely.
So you know we got the promotion that we all, you know, what we all wanted.
So when Mickey left Fulham, did it occur to you, I mean, was the writing ever going to be on the wall, or was it just the next manager said your face doesn't fit, mate, sling your hook? How come you got to come to Brighton?
No, well I was in the team at the time. My agent was a guy called Mel Steen, and me and Matty Lawrence actually were the same agent, and I remember. And we was in the team, both doing really well still. You know, the money had come in, Fired had come in and whatever. Mickey had been given a little bit of money. They never really backed Mickey as they should have.
Mm.
But, of course, when new people come in, they'll probably want their own people in there anyway.
Yeah.
So we sent Mel in to Keegan at the time and said, Mel Wett said, you know, Danny and Matt are doing really well. Regulars in the team. You know, how about they're out of contract? Well, they're doing okay for now, he said. Oh. They're doing well for now. See, then you kind of know. But to be honest, when
Keegan comes in, he's not going to inherit a third or fourth division team, is it?
Nah.
He's going to build for, you know.
Yeah,
the
well, they paid $2 million for Chris Coleman, didn't they? Who's a fantastic player and a fantastic guy. So you know you're always going to be up against it as a young player.
Sure. So you spent a little bit of time across West London.
Yep. Then I moved across to Brentford, followed Mickey there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went there late, to be fair. I think I went in the March, something like that.
Mm.
And unfortunately for Mickey and myself, as it turned out, they had a takeover themselves and a certain Nodes come in.
Oh, I remember him. Mm. Yeah. No, this is the Albion Rule. We don't swear on
air. That's why I said a certain nodes come
in. Yeah, certain nodes, yeah. So, kind of by that time, at that end of that sort of 97-98 season, you probably got to realise, hang on, you know, did you feel that you think, hang on, my career's stalling a bit here. Everywhere I play, I'm doing okay, but, you know, the clubs themselves seem to go under, you know, what's going on?
I never really thought about it, to be fair, because I was always a focused person and, you know, I always wanted to have my future in my hands. Any knockbacks you get, taught at a young age, like I say, from growing up, you just get on with it. You dust yourself down and you go on again.
Sure.
You know, you just got to be a little bit tunnel vision, if you like.
So tell us about how the move to Brighton came about.
Well, the move to Brighton came about, like I said, I was at Brentford. And again, new people come in, but I was actually played the first two games of the season. And funnily enough, played against West Brom. We drew West Brom in the Cup, mm-hmm. Coca-Cola Cup or whatever it was at the time. And it was Dennis Smith, who was my ex-manager at Oxford.
Right.
He was their manager. So I was obviously eager to impress and played really well in the leg at the Hawthorns. Come back to Griffin Park and was playing really well again. And my agent told me there's quite a few scouts watching because I was still only young at the time. And I ended up doing my cruciate. So end up doing
you
my cruciate.
You just pick your moments to get injured, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah. But you know what? I carried on playing with it for 5 minutes. I crawled off and I'm like, this is a bit sore. So I walked around to halfway line, come back on.
This is a bit sore. Your leg's about to fall
yeah,
off.
Yeah, well, that's how it was. Because then I tried to control the ball. It got played down the line and my knee just went like that. So I just give it the, I've got to come off.
Yeah.
yeah.
For the, again, those not watching this in Super Reverb Vision, Danny's just done a cutthroat sort of gesture. Yeah. Yes, he's got to come off. That's enough. So you're saying is that the move to Brighton was kind of delayed a little bit just because you know you'd done.
Yeah, well, I don't think Mickey wasn't there at the time anyway. Then right. he went across to Swansea, I believe, for a short time.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I was out for a year really.
Right.
And when I came to Brighton, you know, lucky for me, Mickey was there.
What do you think of the place as soon as you saw, especially with Dean and Thelma yeah. training sort of swamp?
But, you know, it is what it is. You just got to be professional.
Mm.
And I wasn't used to all the, you know, all the top-notch training facilities everywhere. So, you know, I was brought up with that, with Mickey and all them sort of things. So, and he builds a resilience in you. That's what he wants from his players. You know, he wants honest players. So it was never an issue for me whatsoever, to be honest with you.
So it's fairly legendary. The number of players that we've had here from, you know, sort of like the Mickey Adams alumni, and we're talking about in this studio, we're talking Harty's been in, Kerry, Michelle. I think, well, I can't really say Guy was from the Mickey Adams era, but certainly sort of as part of that thing. We had Chippy, all these various players that we've had in, they'll say, and Charlie, that, you know, were, you know, there's 11 captains on the pitch. But who was it? Was it just literally the individual, a group of 11 sort of raucous individuals, or was it something that Mickey Adams brought about? Was it something he garnered or he nurtured? Or how did you come to be just the sort of like this team that probably scared? Played, but scared its way to the fourth division title.
But that's Mickey, his work ethic. He goes around, he knows the clubs, he knows the players, he knows what type of player he wants, he knew what type of characters he wanted, and he put them people together as a squad to gel.
Mm.
And he wouldn't take no fancy dance if he had happened to sign somebody.
Even Paul Brooker.
But Brozzi still worked his socks off.
Right.
And he was a very good player. And
didn't
and
you change kick, kick him up in the air, though?
He changed it. Well, if I could catch him.
Oh, okay.
But he changed games for you when he came on.
Yes.
And when he started, and Mickey had him at Fulham, you know, so with Brozzi, he could run all day, that boy.
Yeah.
But he was a good lad.
Right.
More to the point. And Mickey.
So you had no passengers?
No.
Because
Brozzi would still have a go. Brozzi would work his socks off.
Yeah. No, I'm talking about anyone in the squad. Anyone who you thought was actually slacking, you think?
Well, anyone that had a higher opinion of themselves than the team.
Yep.
As the squad, as the club.
Soon found out.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Which I think that's right in anything. I think even now that should be the case wherever you are. You should. Yes, it's good individually, but you're playing for your team and your club.
So tell us about the first time you clapped eyes on Bobby Zamora.
Bob, when he come on loan.
Yeah.
When he come on loan, yeah.
Yeah, you just think, really? Look at a puff of wind to take him over.
Yeah, but he's...
What would
you tell?
I mean, did you first meet him in training or a game? I mean, he obviously came to the...
He would have been training.
Yeah.
You know, but you can tell again, the character is, and the biggest compliment I can give to Bob is take away the player side of it.
Yeah.
Is now when you see him when he played all the way through his career, he's exactly the same person.
Yeah,
he hasn't changed. And that's the biggest compliment I can give him. Because everyone knows about his football side of it.
Yeah.
His goals, his natural ability, his work ethic. But it's what he is as a person. And that hasn't changed. And that's what tells you, really, for me, that's what tells you about people, is that they don't change when they get a bit of success. And Sidders is exactly the same. Steve Sidwell is exactly the same. And they
so the Sidwell from on loan as a 12-year-old
exactly the same mentality, person,
yes,
as he was then when he first come. As a person, he's not got
a thorough professional.
Thorough professional, but what I call a good lad.
Yeah,
you know, a good lad that you'd like to talk to. He's got no airs and graces. He doesn't think he's better than anybody else.
Looks out for his mates.
Yeah, but he's not changed. He's not let it change him. You know, some people can get that. Oh, I'm a footballer. Yeah. I'm this. Some people want to be a footballer. The perception of a footballer, then actually play the game.
Mm.
The nuts and bolts of playing the game, going out and competing for your team, for your club, for your mates.
So, okay, moving forward to 2002, I mean, I've just asked you about what you thought when you first met Bobby. What do you think when, bearing in mind you don't remember him at Oxford, what do you remember the first time you met Mr. Butters here on your right?
I was picking grass out of my teeth after the first header. I've played against Guy before.
Yeah.
And you know, he's got a one, as what I noticed from Oxford was he's got a hell of a wand of a left foot, which he still has now, by the way, if you see the goal he scored on...
the one he stands on.
The one he scored in the video we'd done YouTube on, wasn't it? Unbelievable. Yeah. You saw he's had a great left foot, but really dominant in the air. Centre-half, who you want to play alongside, because you know, I used to tackle the ball, but, you know, he's a lot bigger than me, so you know you're not always going to be the one that has to win every single header because you've got another person like Guy alongside you.
I was about to say, wasn't it a case that you always used to win the headers and Guy would just do the mopping up?
That's
the glory that he ever had,
But it's nice that you've got someone that's as willing to attack the ball as yourself and wants to win the headers from corners, from set plays.
So, Guy, you'd been around the block a few times, actually, by the time you turned up at the Albion. I mean, we've had you on before, but tell us how it came to be that you joined the Albion.
I was at Gillingham for, I think it's 5-6 years, sort of in and out of the team. They just bought Chris Hope, who's a centre-half as well, and I had a couple of injuries. Family couldn't settle. We moved to Kent for a year. Family couldn't settle.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved back to Southampton, where I live now. So I was literally travelling near enough every day.
It's far enough from Brighton to Gillingham, as us fans will tell you.
Ian Chapman was obviously was there as well.
Yes.
So I don't know how he done it. He managed to convince me that coming along the coast road and picking him up was the quickest way to get to Gillingham, which I soon found out it wasn't.
Yeah. That's footballers for you.
And then so I sort of stayed in Diggs the odd time as well. So I was always, weren't really comfortable towards the end, you know, not really playing, getting a little injury. I missed pre-season. And then when...
You're good at penalties as well, aren't you?
Yeah, I scored a few there. I missed a couple as well.
Yeah, tell us where.
Wembley, yeah. Nice.
Against whom?
Man City, funny.
Yeah, I know. It's weird when you look back on it. Was it, 20-something? No, not even.
1999, I think.
Yep,
Okay. Nearly 20 years ago, isn't it?
Nearly 20 years ago,
old.
Sorry, you are old.
Martin Inchwood was the reserve team manager at Portsmouth when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew Inch for a few years. I always remember the phone call. He just phoned up and said, you interested? And obviously, jumped at the chance, really. Chance to be nearer home, get back into playing football as well. But it was always in my head that I knew that I'd missed pre-season. That was massive, that was. as was I because at the time.
I was about to say, I mean, I don't think I'm sort of like particularly betraying a confidence here. I mean, I think it's been well documented that you probably were carrying a pound or two. That
But it's like you say,
you worked very hard to shed order to get match fit again.
Yeah, but it's a case of everywhere I've been. I mean, to be honest, I've seen pictures when I was at Tottenham, obviously like a little rake then, but I was younger. But as I got on, I mean, everywhere I'd been, because you're a big fella anyway, naturally thing for a manager to come in and first thing they look at is how big you are, it's not how you carry it or whatever. I had the same with Mark McGee when he first came, you know, it's a similar sort of thing. Luckily enough with that, I got him first and said, look, you know, is there anything you can help me with sort of thing? But, so I was...
It was a good few weeks before you got sort of match fit, wasn't it?
Yeah, but even then, you know, and by that time, Martin had gone and Steve Coppell had come in and sort of, I think the first game, well, the only game really was Sheffield United at home, me and Vergs played, and that was it.
Yeah.
2-0 up with 10 minutes to go. They brought on the cavalry, about four up front.
And a referee.
Yeah, exactly. And we lost, and that was my lot. I think that was my only game, apart from that season, under Steve.
Yeah.
And then I think the next game after that was the Palace 5-0.
Good start,
part
mate.
Of me is, well, I didn't play. Me and Vergs were dropped.
Right.
So part of you thinks, I still get blamed for the goals,
of course.
Though I didn't play.
Yeah. Yeah, you didn't stop them, did you?
No, but okay. then a case of literally, I think about a month later. So yeah, so I think it wasn't a matter of too long after where I went on loan to Barnet, and I was started to get fit, match fit, and I started playing all right. I felt pretty good in myself, and then obviously come back and had a pre-season under my belt, and then played a few games under Steve then.
Sure. I mean, the point is that I was just saying again before we came on air is that, I mean, Guy, you've got 212 games for Brighton under your belt. Danny, you've got 242. So nearly, you know, nearly 500.
Sorry to interrupt. I like that because not many people include the subs appearances, do they? We were talking
about
this before.
No, subs appearances count.
Yeah, we talked about it. I can't remember. I only made one, I think.
Yeah, even if it's 90 seconds at the end.
But we literally talked about this before, because sometimes when you go to...
And the cup games I don't include either. It's all first team.
No, this is all games. No, first team game's a first team game. Even the stupid JPT, or whatever you want to call it, the Hodgman Memorial Teapot.
Stepping one foot on the pitch for more than a minute.
If you're wearing the Albion stripes for a first team game, it's a match, you know. And I know that obviously the pair of you wearing them were pride, but the point I'm making here is the 450 first team appearances between you, and yet you're only together for what, two and a bit years?
Yeah.
So, I mean, we've just heard a little bit from Danny as to what he thought sort of playing alongside, well, certainly playing against you, but alongside you. But what was it like playing alongside Danny? I mean, you know, tell us about your working relationship, both training and for the match.
Oh, it's fantastic. I come from Gillingham, which, to be fair, we had a really good set of lads there. Similar, like Danny said, you know, you've got captains all over the pitch. But we had a good relationship on the pitch and off the pitch. So we could sort of win games, but we knew how to party as well. But we worked hard. So to come into a team like Brighton with similar sort of characters, Charlie, Danny, Chippy, I knew a few from playing against them before, you know, sort of, it was brilliant. But unfortunately for me, like we well documented, like I say, I wasn't fit at the time. But when I got in the team, it was a great experience, brilliant for me. I mean, having someone like Danny alongside me, who was very vocal, very...
And empty with Dean, believe me, we knew it was very cool.
But very, you know, very strong character, brilliant on the pitch. I loved playing alongside him, to be fair. I was gutted when he went.
Yeah.
Because I thought we had a really good partnership. We went, I think that season when we went up, we nearly broke the clean sheet record.
Yeah.
Or if not equaled it.
Well, you had a decent keeper behind you as well, which probably helped.
And I think it was a playoff game at home that put a mucker on that. I think if we'd have kept the clean sheet in that, I think we'd have broke the record at the time for the clean sheet, consecutive clean sheets on the drop. So it's great. Oh, it's brilliant. I loved it.
But I mean, you're talking about, I mean, the team you're mentioning there, it was kind of like the leftovers from the squad that Mickey Adams assembled, and that kept the club sort of on a high. And let's face it, severely restricted by finances and facilities and everything. And I mean, there was obviously a togetherness at the club, which there still is now, because obviously the fans were campaigning for the stadium. And actually, before I ask the question, I mean, tell us about the off-field stuff. I mean, because was there ever a distraction? I mean, we always think about the Wickham away game or the marches and what have you. You think, hang on, I'm a professional footballer, I shouldn't have to do this. But, you know, you guys kind of got stuck in.
I mean, for me personally, I just think it's the character of the lads. I think the way that people have been brought up.
You didn't have to be three-line whipped into sort of like supporting the club on this.
We were sort of brought up on council estates. You sort of mucked in together then. You know, if anything went on in the community, you were there. And it's the same as in football. You've got that. I think that if you've got that inside you and you've been brought up for them sort of morals and them beliefs, I think anything that's asked of you, really, I think that you get involved in.
When you see what it means to the fans and you've been in amongst the club, then you understand, he's talked about, did I understand history before when I was at Fulham? No. When you're there and you see the hard work from behind the scenes that everybody's putting in, you then kind of, the group that we had, wanted to be involved in it. And it was certainly not a distraction. It was an incentive to do right for us, for the club, against everybody else. Everyone's against you. Mentality, which is something that Mickey used to install in you. Mm-hmm. So that siege mentality, we kind of wanted to help and wanted to get involved. And after the games, I remember all the time we used to go into the Sportsman, have a beer with the fans, go into the porter cabins, have a beer with the fans. But you was amongst it.
Yeah.
And it was normal. It was normal because of the group of players that you had.
And even now, we get stewards that have worked at the Withdean. You know, they come up and chat to us like it was like we've seen them yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, and they fondly remember us boys because we all stopped and chatted to them.
And you see a picture of them 15 years ago. Oh, weren't you young? Well, yeah. And you think you've got, almost like you've grown with them, haven't you?
It's building up that relationship of Withdean. Everyone was in it together. You know, everyone knew what it was. We all knew that it was a temporary home. We knew this, that and the other was there. Not the greatest place, obviously, but it was a real togetherness and a real bond, and everyone that worked there all stuck together, as Danny said. You know, you build up them sort of friendships over the years.
But I'm a big believer in you treat everybody exactly the same. Doesn't matter who they are, doesn't matter whether they're, you know, a road sweeper or a multi-millionaire. They all get treated exactly the same unless they treat you badly or they're rude. And then that's normal nature. That's how I think you should treat everybody. So
similar philosophy from the likes of Dick Knight, though, isn't it? But I mean, that comes from the top of the club.
But yeah,
it?
But it comes from, like Guy said, where you was brought up, how you was brought up, where you was brought up, and the group of people as a club that you are all amongst, and everybody had that mentality.
You'll find as well, the people like me, Danny, Chippy, Charlie, I got an holiday, or I used to go on holiday when I played, and people would ask me what you get friendly with someone who's, you know, on the next bed, sunbed or whatever, you have a beer with them. And they asked me what I did for a living, and I never say I was played football. I'd say I was a roofer or something. Or
I was a scaffolder.
Yeah, honestly.
Do you know, I'll buy that from you too.
But yeah, but seriously, ask Rage. You know, but yeah. I didn't want anyone to, I still don't like people knowing that I play football.
Because?
I don't know. It's just,
you feel like you're stuck on a pedestal or something?
But I think there's a lot of people in the game that do give it a bad name, and I didn't want to be associated with that or come across as if I'm a bit flash or anything. Yeah. So I never was.
Or even the risk of hangers-on or something.
Well, you know.
Well, just people will treat you different one way or the other.
Right.
Whether it's in a good way.
Yeah, either overly reverential or like dirt.
Or they're flashy footballers. You're in a group with your mates, for instance, having a laugh.
Yeah.
And it won't be, there's a young group of lads having a laugh, having a beer. Oh, look at them, fair play to them. Mm. It'll be, there's a load of flash footballers. Yeah. When you're not behaving any different to everybody else.
Sure.
So you get the kind of the two. So you just want to be on a... Me, personally, I prefer to be under the radar. As you know, that's why I've not been on the show before.
Got you eventually.
Yeah.
No, but the point is, you just want to sort of like...
But you should be... I don't think you should be treated any different than anybody else, because you're not any different from anybody else.
You want to be introduced as Danny Cullip, the footballer.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. Treat me for what I am as a person. If you like me, you like me. If you don't, fair play. It's up to you.
And I think that's why I've always lived away from football clubs. I've always lived away. I've always, travelled there, because I don't... After a game, I just want to go back to my own life, do what
Absolutely.
I do. I just want to go back to Mr. Getting moaned at because I haven't done the washing up at home or something. Do you know what I mean? Just back to the normal
person.
Do
the washing up, then.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's true, you know.
No.
Yeah.
No, but you're saying about sort of the camaraderie between the players and the fans. And I'd like to think that probably in most cases it's kind of a respectful. I mean, there's going to be the kids that are going to be sort of, you know, very, very keen and full. And into that. But and you'd like to think that some sort of 45-year-old bloke has actually grown out of that a bit and just would try and natter with you for the sake of you being another fella. But, I mean, do you ever get to the point where you think, you know, enough's enough and I have to sort of retreat here? Or were you always happy to go and talk to the fans and have a beer afterwards?
Yeah, me personally, I loved it.
So the Saturday, you kind of put your block of Saturday aside and said, right, okay, finish the game, go and have a beer, and then bang, that's it.
But, you know, I mean, you know Hindy, didn't you? Does the programmes. Yeah. He lives around the corner from where I am in Southampton.
Yeah, but he loves you.
But that's how I first met him, though.
And you love him.
I do.
Okay.
But that's how I first met him, though, because the kids used to go to the same school.
Yeah.
And I remember pulling up behind his car and it had the Brighton and Hove Albion sticker in the back.
Yeah.
And I sort of got out and sort of looked and he didn't even give me a second glance.
Yeah, well, that's Heine for you.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think he'd see me. But, yeah, but you know, after the Bournemouth game, away game, we both went back home, went in a pub on New Year's Day, watching the darts.
Yeah.
He's just, yeah, I'll chat
to him.
I love it.
Yeah, the fact he's a fan and a mate is kind of weird,
isn't it? I personally like meeting people.
Yeah.
I love the part of meeting people and talking to them. And if it's football, it's football. If it's whatever, I just love being around talking to people.
I'm not talking about Brighton fans when I say about, you know, I don't want people to look at you and say, oh, there's a footballer. I'm always any fan, whether it's any club I played for, it's more the ones that don't know you, just, oh, there's a footballer over there. Oh, who's he play for? So-and-so. Oh, then they make the preconceived idea.
Mm.
I'm always happy to speak to Brighton, any fans about anything. It's more the ones that don't know you, don't know really who you are as such, or an opposition fan who sees you and, oh, you must be like that, like you are on the pitch or whatever. Them sort of ones, you know what I mean?
Mm.
Always happy to speak to
I think
people.
You'll find as well, a lot of footballers, sounds weird, but not schizophrenic, but a bit of a Jekyll and Hyde. You're on the pitch, you've got to be like that. You've got to be, you know, a bit of an animal. You've got to be a bit
When I see you two sitting here all calm and peaceful, you know, rewind 15 years, cross the white line, you know, scare the living daylights out of me.
But then after that, when you're away from that, and you're representing your club still, so then you've got the normal face on, that you are polite, just being a normal person, and people can't sometimes differentiate between the two. They expect you to be a little what you are on the pitch. It's strange.
Absolutely. Listen, talking of people getting close to people, you used to room with Adam Virgo, didn't you, Danny?
I let him come in the room every now and again.
Even if he was having the other bed. Now then, what's this about you not allowing them to turn the telly over while you're having a bath?
Absolute rubbish. Because I never used to go down for dinner because I had my own routine when I was here.
Right.
So I'd bring a load of pasta and all that on the bus, and I'd have it on the bus, and then I'd get to the room.
Yeah.
I'd have a bath. He'd be down at the pre-match having his dinner. I'd be there having my bath, having a stretch, and I'd get room service.
Right.
At my own cost, by the way. So
right.
Not putting on the...
No.
Yeah, so I wouldn't be seen till the next morning. So I kept myself to myself in that sense and had a stretch. So all of that is absolute tosh.
Okay.
Whereas I was the one down at the pre-match evening meal, eating everything.
You're having Danny's portions.
Carb loading the night before.
Fair enough. So, I mean... When it comes to sort of being out on the road, I mean, do you have a choice as to who you room with, or you just lumbered? And who's got the best and worst habits?
I used to room on my own,
right?
Because like I said, I had my own certain routine as such. If there was a possibility of having a room on your own, I'd have my own room because I used to go in, have my bath, have a stretch, have my room, and that was it. I was kind of focused on what I had to do the next day. Some people needed roomies; they loved having a roomie.
Yeah.
Me, I prefer just to get my head down and work it like that. But then, you know, whenever, if I needed to have a room, weren't a problem at all.
Whereas you just blared out the hood, didn't you?
Yeah, I just had the old airplanes up. No, it's like Danny said, you get some of the lads used to bring the PlayStations along with them, they'd be up all night having a FIFA tournament or something. Everyone's different. True. But I was similar to Danny. I liked a bit of peace and quiet night before a game.
Mm.
Put the old, have I got news for you or whatever is on, watch that, and then set in your own routine and basically concentrate on the game the next day.
Mm.
Same again on the match day. I could never eat too near a game, so I had to get up in the morning, have a breakfast and that.
Yeah,
so everyone's different. Loads of people could eat
yeah.
two and a half, 3 hours before a game and cram it in. And I'm like, wow,
you're talking chicken, pasta, jacket potatoes, at half 11, 12 o'clock.
Yeah, don't know.
I could never do that.
But I remember Martin Keown saying about Arsenal when they used to... Wenger used to insist they used to have some spag bowl, etc. And when they used to have an early kickoff, he said it was a nightmare, like 9 o'clock in the morning trying to eat spag bowl. He said it's just ridiculous. But
everyone
yeah.
prepares their own way, don't they? Anyway, yeah. Every player's different. You know, you probably had quite a few players on, and players can be quite superstitious in certain things, wearing putting what boot on first,
right?
Wearing a lucky pair of socks, or having a routine. You know, and that, like I said, that was kind of our routine, really.
Right.
I'm a creature of habit when I was playing. I loved my routine.
Habit or superstition?
Both, a little bit, but more of a habit, I like what I did. Because when you get yourself in a good habit, or a habit, and things start going wrong, you can and you've veered off of your path a little bit, you can kind of say, do you know what, actually I didn't do that, or I did do that.
That's a superstition, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's a habit as well, though, because if you're doing the same thing, preparation that's going well, if something goes bad and then you change your habit and it you change your habit and it goes bad, so it's a bit of both, I suppose.
Did you have any that sort of lasted a career, either of you?
I had, I literally used to do the warm-up, come in after the warm-up, get my shirt on and my pads, and then I used to go to the sink, cold water, regardless if it's winter or whatever, splash the face 3 times, back of the neck 3 times, bit of Vic on the chest and up the nostrils, and then sniff smelling salts like they're going out of fashion, which was good on a Saturday, but on a night game, I'd be wide awake till about 3-4 in the morning, couldn't sleep. But yeah, just things like that was it, really, for me.
Mine was more
to... Yeah, sorry, and I think I was third out, so it'd be the captain, keeper, then me.
Got ya.
I was more to prep for the game, really. I used to get in Malcolm and the doc, bless him. I used to get in at about 11 o'clock and get stretched to the 9th degree. Which was a bit of an issue when I moved out of Brighton.
Note to self, Danny, you're not 6'7".
No, I know, I had my routine of stretching, and fair play to Malcolm Stewart. He done it. Harold Shipman,
as we call him.
I'm not getting involved in that.
The best one I had was Gary Lineker when he first came over for Tottenham.
Yeah.
He used to put about literally half an inch of hot water in a bath and sit in it to warm his hamstrings up
and
his calves. So he didn't like going out to do the warm-up. So Gaz has obviously seen him do it. So what are you doing? And he explained it to him. So he's filled a whole bath up of scorching hot water, got in it, got out, and literally couldn't move.
Set his legs on fire.
First half, he couldn't run.
Glenn Cockrell used to have hot bath as well before games.
Yeah. Like, who did, sorry?
Glenn Cockrell used to have hot baths for, and then you just think, what, you're going to be sweating, mate. But but he was...
It makes sense to warm the muscles.
Everyone prepares differently.
I was about to say, you probably didn't have that luxury at the With Dean changing rooms, did you?
No, they weren't.
A bath,
no, not at all. Yeah.
So dribble off a shower.
Yeah.
Especially at something. I think it might predate you. I'm not sure, but I think it might predate you. The home match, and I've asked Bob Booker about this. I've asked Michelle Kuypers about it. I've asked Harty about it. It was a big bundle after the game against Chesterfield.
Yeah.
Where it wasn't so much, the scrap itself that happened. And don't get me wrong, Danny, it's the stuff of folklore. Harty himself said that Michelle Kuypers saved him from getting his head caved through the Coke machine. But the floor collapsed. True?
Yeah.
Now, we shouldn't actually sort of glorify fighting and violence and things like that, but I bet you had a good time, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. But then you saw the two. Nicky Law was their manager,
yeah,
as well, and he
piled in.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, he was a growler, wasn't he?
Yeah,
and that was the good. That was the beauty of it. I remember playing Chesterfield away actually, and
the one where Charlie got sent off.
Yeah, but the wind.
Oh right,
the wind. Michelle's goal kicks. We was lining up on the 18-yard box to head them back. They were coming. There was such a heavy wind. Yeah. And you just had to dig in. But always the games against them were competitive because of their manager.
Yes,
our manager. Similar to Swindon games were kingy.
Oh right,
because when the manager's like that on the touchline as well,
yeah,
it kind of their teams are a little
ball-like,
bit like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, the team are a little bit like it.
Who was the Swindon fellow who gave a bit of verbal to Adam Virgo at the playoff semi-final?
Oh, on the play, that would have been Parkin and yeah. Mooney.
Yeah, and Parkin.
Parkin said, I'll wave to you at the playoff final.
Yeah.
Talking of which, who broke the trophy?
But do you know what, I get blamed for sitting on it or something. But if you actually...
If you'd sat on it, then it wouldn't have been that.
But there was a picture, they got it on the pitch, and it's bent on the pitch, so it couldn't have been me in the changing room.
So
that's my
it?
Excuse.
We,
I don't know.
Was it a hot day and it melted?
Could have been.
It was a very hot day, I've got to say. It was
Remember
a very,
the fireworks?
Very hot day.
Yeah, I do, when we come out.
Yeah.
Boiling.
Yeah, no, so I've just assumed someone must have chucked it to someone and it got dropped, but...
Is that the best stadium you played at?
I played at Wembley. I was very fortunate to play there.
Was Millennium, which was better though?
To be fair, I loved them both. I like they're different because Wembley's a bit more open, but the Millennium was really tight in, and I loved the tight.
That was lovely. Yeah,
yours was the old Wembley though, wasn't it?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Yeah. That was a fantastic stadium, that Millennium, and the build up to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like being an FA. I've been used to watch the FA Cup finals. I remember me and Chippy doing,
and the coach sort of making its way through.
Yeah, but even before that, I remember me and Richard Carpenter going into Gresham Blake's and doing the filming of that, and then coming out with a suits on our shoulders.
Yeah.
I tell you, from that day actually, I remember the guy that used to be the one that ran the day for Sky. For the TV, he goes, "You lot are going to win today." So both teams were on the pitch because we were suited and booted.
Yeah,
they had track suits on, and he said, "I fancy you lot today." I said, "Why is that?" He said, "Well, you just look the part. You're in your suits. You look like you're more mentally for it,
tuned for it." Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the tactics seem to be set up that we had a bit of a spoiling game for Bristol City because, I mean, you know, make no bones about it, they're a decent side.
Yeah.
I think finished above us in the table, didn't they?
Yeah, everything about that, though, was spot on. We got everything, the pre-match stuff, the night before, just everything was the build-up, everything was spot on. I mean, like I said, I've been to Wembley twice, funny enough, with
Gillingham. Was it Chris McPhee got sat on his balcony, locked out of his balcony?
Dan Harding, I think,
Harding,
got locked
that was
on
it,
the
yeah.
balcony. But
yeah.
I remember I was in a room with Adam Inchwood, and we because West Ham played Palace the day before.
Yes, they did, yeah.
And they were all... Palace fans were in the hotel in the lobby downstairs, and I remember throwing a peanut. Eddie's are dead. I missed him, but
I thought you were going to say that because the Hinchwood family are very much Palace oriented, aren't they?
Yeah, but it was just a build up. It was just nice being, you know, great,
nice
great place, Cardiff.
Yeah,
and like you say, the coach going in, all you could see was sort of red everywhere, and you think, oh god, how many fans have we got here? And then all of a sudden, you turn a corner, it's blue everywhere. It's just great, like hot days. Danny said, remember coming out. The lineups coming out, and then the fireworks going off behind you, and you're like, wow.
Yeah.
But I've got a picture at home, the panoramic view of it, and it's the whole stadium's in it, and it's got caught it with the fireworks going off, and we were on the pitch. Brilliant.
Yeah. I don't know if any of the boys have mentioned it before, but one of the inspiring things as you was going out before the game and at half time, McGee done a very clever thing. He had two whiteboards,
mm-hmm.
one with all the teams in our league.
Mm-hmm.
The
smaller
ones,
teams, yeah.
the northern
stadiums.
Journeys, the really bad journeys, the long, long journeys. And then he had on the other one, the other stadiums, the big ones.
Leeds
the
and
big,
Norwich.
Yeah,
and,
West Ham, yeah. all the big stadiums, And then he just put in capitals, where would you rather be?
So that's the point. He's made a point of saying that. I mean, you're kind of familiar with that story, but that's him saying that, and he said the players responded. I mean, it's interesting. You're saying it is how you guys responded. I mean, him saying it is one thing, but it's how you took it in. I mean, was there sort of like a light bulb went on, or was it just something that,
It was a build-up to that. And then seeing that visually as you go out, and having it rammed in. Where do you want to be? Where do you want to be? There, mm. there. And you go out and you get goosebumps now talking about it when you do. But that's what you do. That's how you got it. You got your hair start. That's where I want to be. Like, my brothers are big West Ham fans. Mm. So, you know, wanted to go, and they were there the day before.
Yeah. And they lost, didn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, yeah, so they come up the next day to watch me.
All right.
But, you know, and that's, yeah, I want to go and play against them, go to Upton Park and go to Elland Road, them sort of places, you know, the Leicesters, these sort of places.
I sort of do remember as well him saying about, you know, obviously it's important for the club financial-wise, because without that, I remember him saying there'd be a few that players probably go. Be out of contract.
Yeah. Right.
And I thought, hello, in my age, it's probably one of them is going to be me. So I remember that as well. So that's, you know, that's another incentive as well. But
the thing is, we went up and you stayed anyway.
Yeah, but that's what, you know, so we've probably got a bit more finance.
Well, you were expensive. Finances.
Yeah, I was actually. Yeah, okay. Big taste, the food bill and that.
Harty used to moan every year that every time he got a new contract, he got a pay cut.
He needs to negotiate better than that. Yeah.
But then, yeah, probably half of it, what he means is the relegation clause in it. So every time we sort of went up, we come back down. But, yeah,
now,
no.
Following season, I think you had probably the two of the most memorable away trips that, or you were a major feature in two of the most memorable away trips in certainly in those days. I'm talking about away at Leeds and away at West Ham. Yeah. And both cases, I was there. I think it was the Leeds one, you scored a header to equalise. And the West Ham one was to win. And I've said this on this show several times before, and it's one of the reasons why I never gamble, is I went into the ground and saw one of these sort of bookies boards that says Brighton to win 1-0, Guy Butters to score first. In other words, you know, 170-1.
Miracle,
you think, I think 10 quid, that's a happy weekend in the pub. Didn't take the bet because I know full well I'd rather have the Brighton win. I'd rather have,
the tenner more likely.
Yeah, the tenner is going to get your little spent faith, anyway. But you know, well, the thing is, if I'd have taken a bet, it wouldn't have happened. So, you know, if you're going to, you talk about superstition and fate and things like that, then, that kind of thing. But you must, I mean, it's one of those things that kind of, you know, there is that element of, you know, with your combativeness, Danny, but your sort of, you know, sort of cheeky, chubby, sort of, I've scored a goal that's got us points.
Well, as Danny said, his brother's a West Ham fan. My dad's a West Ham fan as well. But I remember we went to the game and Danny, I don't know how he played, to be honest, because he was ill. He was sick in the changing room. I didn't even know. Yeah, I was sort of...
I mean, Danny's looking at me sort of all sheepishly as if to say, I'm making this admission for the first time ever.
When you go into West Ham, there's the biggest policeman you've ever seen. He's about 6'8". I don't know if it's just a case of being
a waxwork or something
he's
a huge real, copper.
He's huge.
Right.
So I remember just walking past him, and I think I said I wouldn't want to pick him up at set pieces, just a little silly joke, and walked in the change room, and then there's the crest. Someone's cleaning up all this sick on the crest in the change room. What's happening there? And then someone said, Danny's been ill. But funny enough, I got ill after the game, and Mel was ill as well. There was a virus going on.
Oh, right. And not sick with nerves, then.
But I was bedridden for 3 days. I don't know how he played. I still don't know how he managed to play that game.
I remember getting on the coach in the morning, and I felt rotten. And we got to the hotel. Obviously, Docklands, I think.
I think it was the one that Tottenham stayed when there was a lasagna gate.
They went in there. I walked in.
Yeah.
Just smelt food. I said, I'm going to wait on the coach. So I didn't have nothing to eat at all. So I felt rough. So I didn't have nothing in the morning.
I said, can you eat on an empty? Can you play on an empty
Yeah,
stomach?
I did, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But then, got into Upton Park. I was white as I go. So I got into Upton Park, walked into the changing room, past the big friendly giant.
Yeah.
And I was sick. I projectile vomited all over the crest. As you walk in, they got their crest. And when I told my brother, we weren't too happy about it. I felt fantastic after.
All right.
So I got all the...
Something had been cleared out.
Cleared it all out, played the game, felt rotten after the game,
yeah.
Obviously, because I had nothing to eat or anything. But yeah, I walked, literally opened the door, projectile vomited all over the crest.
Fantastic.
Cleared it up, and then we played, didn't we?
Because also, Virgs got sent off that day.
Yeah.
After a bundle with Hayden Mullins.
Hayden Mullins, yeah.
What do you remember about the goal, Guy?
I think it was a wide free kick, chippy... I think Steve Claridge played, didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
I think Steve comes short, played a little 1-2 with Chippy, give it back to him, and then just the ball in. I just remember sort of the ball coming in and thinking that I could get on the end of this, and it was Callum Davenport was marking me.
Right.
So I sort of remember just sort of jumping on his back, using him as a bit of a ladder.
Yeah.
And it sort
Which wasn't spotted.
Yeah. You see it after the clip, he's running off after the ref.
Moment,
I've fouled him.
Tough.
And it's just skidding off the floor and going in. And then next thing I know, it's weird when you score because there's a little... Probably only a nanosecond,
yeah.
But it seems like ages of all this in, and then the crowd react.
Right.
Because it was right behind that goal.
Yes, it was.
And that's the main thing, sort of running off. And I run towards the West Ham split behind the goal.
Yes.
And I quickly managed to realise and run round the back of the goal, yeah, back towards the Brighton fans. And then, yeah, just brilliant. But, I mean...
Well, you would have been in the box at the same time, wouldn't you? Because if it was a free kick...
Yeah, I can't remember it, to be honest with you, but I'm not sure I chased him. I think I probably just went back because I was knackered, I think.
Yeah, right. But I never... Even when teammates score, a lot of them, you look now, Matty Ryan or someone's running the length of the pitch.
Save your energy.
Yeah. So me doing that, but it was obviously in the heat of the moment. But absolutely, normally I wouldn't have bothered. But I knew how to get away from the West Ham fans. But
Now the main thing I remember about that and the Leeds goal is that in both cases, as I jumped up to celebrate, I whacked my knee on that, because in those days, you know, at Upton Park, for all the fact it looked a magnificent ground. I mean, this is the weird thing is about when you've got the Amex and consider how it is and how much leg space you have and how wide the seats are and what have you, and just how much room you have compared to these fabulous old grounds. West Ham was dangerous, bloody dangerous. And I stood up and I really whacked my knee against the chair in front. And I did exactly the same thing against Leeds. So any knee injuries that I've ever had, my entire football career being scuppered, is down to you. Admittedly, I was 34 at the time. You know, I know I'm a month older than you. But
yeah. but even that game, you know, the character of the lads to hang on. I mean, it was like the Alamo at one stage. You know,
Bobby came on, didn't he?
Yeah.
Bobby,
Redbroff come on in that game, didn't he?
Redbroff.
Yeah. Hutchinson.
Well, I think that the West Ham absolutely battered us 0-0. I mean, they were just peppering the goal in the first bit. Yeah. And then I think it got to sort of partway through the second half. And they thought they've run out of ideas. Yeah. And we were kind of getting forward a little bit.
And another big club where, you know if you go there and you keep it quiet for 20, 25 minutes, half an hour, and then the crowd start to turn on their players a little bit. You could sense
Which
that.
Which is what the Albion had been doing this season, to be honest.
You could sense it. You could sense, you know, another one's like Millwall, Portsmouth, them big sort of clubs that are brilliant when they're winning, you know, and they really get behind them, but it can also have a little bit of a bad effect on them if it don't go right for them.
So is it true that afterwards, when you got back into the changing room, you all started laughing, saying, how did we do that?
We're just giggling. It's just, it's surreal, like, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, for those not watching his Super Reverb vision, Danny's just sort of like, you know, bent his is, you know, that was doubled up in laughter. Yeah,
it was, honestly. It was just brilliant because you're just against all the odds, really. Mm. You know, the Leeds one was quite pleasing as well because who's the assistant who's with Warnock now, isn't it? Blackwell.
Kevin Blackwell.
I remember walking down towards changing rooms before the game, and he sort of said, like, all right, like that. I went, all right. And as he walked off behind me, I heard him say to a steward, who's that? Like, just to get a cheap laugh. And so after I scored and I see him down the corridor, I mean, you do remember me now, didn't you? Yeah. I cleaned that up, by the way.
Yeah.
You do remember me now, old chap.
Yes. Quite. Yeah, and it's nice to get your sort of karma banter back, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's that's, again, you know, it's probably the measure of the bloke. But
absolutely. And given the squad, I mean, you're sort of moving forward. I mean, I think it's one of those kind of underrated things that, you know, with all due respect to you guys, that, you know, in order to compete at the top end of the second division, you realise you've got to sort of throw mega money at it. And the club, it's taken getting to the Amex and throwing millions at it in order to get out the division upwards. But the fact is that you guys managed to sort of, you know, survive for a season in that division. And I'd say, it doesn't say, you know, oh, shock horror, you did it. But with all due respect to you guys, it was kind of, you know, the rest of the team around you was never going to be challenging for the top division.
And I'm completely biased, but I still think that's just as good an achievement as the lads getting
the promotion in the first.
I do, really do.
If you have a look at the squads that them teams had. If you have a look at the squads that the West Ham's had, the Leicester's had, you know, the West Brom. Yeah, but you have a look at their squads and what the internationals and all that. You look at our game against United last week.
Mm.
Our work rate, our attitude, our endeavour, much better than theirs.
Yes,
and that's what we've done all season.
Yeah.
And we've got our just rewards against Arsenal, exactly the same. We outworked a team that was so, on paper, superior to what ours is.
Mm.
But you can be superior, but if you haven't got the work ethic,
absolutely,
that all the Brighton teams I've seen since we've been here, obviously I haven't seen since, but we've watched a lot of games since we retired, it seems that the club install that in every squad, is that work ethic. And I think that probably comes back to where the club's come from, and the people behind the scenes have had to work hard, the fans have had to work hard. But that's kind of, that's what, that result's kept us up the Man United game, and that was from pure hard work and endeavour and outworking your opponent. And this year we've had to do that every game. And we've got some fantastic results out of it as a club and as a team. Exactly what we used to have to do.
Sure.
Every single game in that championship was first and foremost, we've got to match or be better physically than the opposition. Mm. And you'd be surprised how far you can go this season. And we've got great quality as well this season, by the way. But the work ethic that the boys have shown, that's what's kept us up.
Absolutely. No, I mean, I think that season, wasn't we beat Sunderland, who were the eventual champions down at Withdean.
Beat Wolves 4-1.
Yes.
Beat Forest. Watford. Beat Bradford, who had Leicester come away. Down. Leicester away.
Mm.
Massive budgets, these teams.
Yes, Reading with the pass back, the quick goal between Kitson and Zamora.
But this is what I'm saying to.
That was 2 years previously.
It's something that's embedded in all the squads that we've seen. Mm. You know, now is that whoever's been here as manager and when we was manager, it's that work ethic. Mm. You've got to work hard, and we haven't ever had anybody that hasn't put that into their teams or teams that haven't taken it on.
Mm. I do remember quite a few occasions when we were at the Withdean waiting on the steps to come down, and people sort of just looking. You get that sense when they're sort of trying to look at you up down a little bit and looking at the surroundings, thinking,
what's all this about?
Yeah, what are you doing in this division? Sort of thing. So it just steals you a little bit as well. You know, you want to go out there and sort of prove a few people wrong. I found that was sort of to our advantage quite a bit.
Mm.
But
it's because you also, I think, by the sound of things, you also sort of had within you and sort of probably inserted into your DNA this not the siege mentality, because I mean that sounds a little bit Fergie-ish like, but this thing that, as you've pointed out, it's not Little Brighton, but actually you're part of something that's a resurgence. I mean, we've talked about, let's fast forward to 2017, to last year, and we've talked about that 20-year journey. I mean, you guys played obviously a major, major part of it, you know, for a few years. But the point is that you actually have bought into the whole philosophy, the whole ethic, not just as people, but as part of Brighton and Hove Albion. You bought into it. So when someone actually sort of looks at you sniffily and says, "What on earth is this?" I say, "Well, this is a football club we're very proud of." That's what seems to come across.
Yeah, obviously it's an insult, you know, just what gives them the right to look at someone or look at the surroundings that they're from. I mean, as Danny said before, it goes back to when you've been brought up. I mean, I used to have to go to school. All my mates got Adidas stuff on. I've got two stripes on my thing. I had to fill the extra one in.
Got some green flash Dunlops.
Yeah, but you are. And I wanted what they had. So I knew that I had to go out and work hard for it. And, you know, my mum had three jobs when I was a kid. You know, that sort of background. So to go out there and have someone...
Putting out the fire in the bedroom.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she went to that when she came home with that one, I tell you. I don't know. But, you know, again, mother's love, isn't it? She knew what I'd done, but... sort of
matches of believe, the day.
Yeah. Believe the story that I sort of said that something must have happened and I don't know how it got the spark, but she knew. But it's a mother's love, isn't it? But so then, you know, to go and have someone look down their nose at you a little bit, like you said, though, it was sort of the beauty of it with players like Danny, Chippy, Charlie in that era, you know, we wouldn't let anyone else come into that fold. Mm. Young kids coming through, whatever they were, people from the outside that had been brought to the club. They learned that ethic pretty quickly. Otherwise, they were told in no uncertain terms that that's not the way to do things. Mm. You know, and you've got to buy into that.
Mm. But I think if you ask the ones that we talked about earlier, Bobby and Sidders, you ask them what they said it's one of the best times of their careers, and it taught them a lot being in that environment.
Sure,
you know, as it taught me a lot when I first come into the environment where Mickey had senior pros in there at Fulham. You know, the Glenn Cockles, the Simon Morgans of the world, you know, the Mark Blakes, Mickey Conways. You learn from and they loved it. And I bet you they'd say to you, that stood them in good stead going on in their careers. Mm. But what you'll find is Brighton, you know, we talk about being a special club, is the reason because the players are told about the history. The players are told what the fans are about to do, what the board have what to do, what all the people in amongst the club have to do. And you buy into it. And if you don't buy into it, you're not here.
Mm.
And you should buy into it. You know.
So the club would probably be prepared to sacrifice a really good player coming along if their faith won't fit.
Well, yeah, we've had it. I'm not going to mention any names, but we have had it. And I'm not going to mention any names. Mm. But we have had it, and I'm sure you'll have it again. But, you know, from what I can see, everyone's buying into it. Everyone knows it. Everyone knows the history of the football club, how lucky we was, you know, to be able to come back to Brighton, play at the Withdean for them years, work our socks off to get the stadium, built, and now look where we are. We're in the Premier League. Mm. You know, it's a different world now.
And also, I think as well, that's why a lot of us have gone on to work in the community scheme, because I think that people see that, you know, of that sort of belief that we had when we were players, and like you say, buying into the whole Brighton thing. I think they've taken that on now to use us, especially in the community scheme. Obviously, a few have gone off to do other things that they've wanted to do, but me and Danny have stayed.
Sure.
And, you know, and I think when we go out there and talk to people in the community, I think they've got that little connection with us as well from them years, and see the way that how we played is how we do things in the community.
It's no coincidence that the football club have supported that, not just on the community side with us, Chippy, Michelle, who was here, Harty, who was here. You've got Jonesy that come in,
mm-hmm.
Ben Roberts that come in, Watto that was here,
mm.
Dodge that was here. You've got all players that were playing here that the club have employed because they know that we know what the club's about.
Right, we'll talk about what you guys exactly do with AITC in a minute, but come to the end of 2004, Danny, it got to the point where either it was decided or you decided it was time for Passage News. So how did it come to be that it was time to leave the Albion?
Well, you know, I've been here for 5.5 years and absolutely loved my time here. Mickey had obviously moved on. We'd had lots of different managers and I loved playing for every single one of them. But, you know, there was a chance at the time that the stadium was still on the back burner and the opportunity just come to try and have that push to the Premier League with Sheffield United, who were, quite high up in the Championship at the time.
Do you think you'd have possibly, it's a question for, 14 years later, but do you think there's a higher probability you'd have stuck around if you saw that the stadium was going to be closer on horizon than it was eventually was?
Yeah, definitely, without sure, because I love the area, which is the reason I moved back to the area. You know, both my kids are born, the Sussex kids. So I loved the area. I was always going to come back and live in the area. And if the stadium was there, I wouldn't have left for sure.
Sure.
Wouldn't have left at all.
Sure. So, Guy, talking about sort of your time up, I think you were sort of asked, thanks very much, no more, at 2008 when you were sort of, what?
38.
Cool. And here we are sort of like lauding Bruno for how old and
sweet. Can't remember how I celebrated that. Oh yeah, I think you had.
Yeah, so I was just about to mention, let's blow each other's trumpet here. And this is actually how it's down to you that I actually got this gig sitting in front of this microphone. Because what had happened was that and it was 10 years ago this month, I was invited onto the Albion Raw by the then presenters Johnny and Richie. And I said, look, we've got this appreciation do we're having for Guy Butters. I've got to say it was Matt Potter's idea originally to do this. And he said, what should we do? I think the original idea was a boxing do. Well, I just can't. I can't stand boxing. So I thought,
what was Guy in the ring? Or
say, yeah, that would have been funny, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I don't know if there's a weight division for that, is there?
Yeah. It wouldn't be the floor of the changing rooms holding you. So yeah, we just had this quiet table in the corner for 80, didn't we? At Donatello's.
Yeah.
The fact it was me that sort of kind of organised it doesn't actually sort of it's not the point. The point is that it's further indication of, the appreciation of fans. Have to players, and players, I think, probably have to fans.
Yeah, that's like special.
Sorry we didn't do that for you, Danny, but,
No problem.
Okay, absolutely fine. Special night. Yeah, special night. Like you say, Heine done their nice speech as well.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, so brilliant.
Professing lots of love for you. Yeah. I think his principal thing was that you realised that when you were at Spurs, Portsmouth or Gillingham, in each case, you didn't have a testimonial.
Yeah, I know.
And the same at Brighton. They couldn't offer it. So, let's do something
years,
for you.
6 years at every club, I think.
Something like that. Yeah.
So it's
5-6 years,
it's fantastic. I really appreciate what you lot done. It was nice just to see the good turnout. But again, a lot of people that I've grown friendly with and got talking to over the years, and they all turned out for that night. I remember the next, I obviously went to play non-league football then, and the next day I was having to go down to Avon and Waterlooville, sign a contract and get weighed and all that stuff. So I like to say I watched what I ate and drunk, but I didn't.
No.
But yeah. And
you drove you back, didn't he?
Yeah, I moved a year ago, probably around about now, funny enough, so I had to clear my loft out, and I've got the old shorts down with KFC on them.
Absolutely.
The old KFC shorts.
The thing is, we went round raiding the club shop, which was in Queen's Road in those days, and I, for the life of me, I can see his face. I cannot think of the name of the fella who was serving us. Ian. Ian was the club shop manager. Ian Green.
Ian Green,
and he had the largest pair of shorts, and he said, no, I haven't, they're a gift. And we sort of laid them out, and he put the KFC number 14 on it. And we that was that frame that we've got for you was the biggest we could find, and even then, it was only just...
We had to fold them over.
I mean, these shorts were enormous. Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong, we just sort of did that for giggles. But and also did a little invitation in the style of Maximum R&B, the Who posting.
Yeah,
you know, so
that's
brilliant. You're big
one.
On that.
Yeah.
No,
got my boy a Wii as well, didn't you? The Wii.
Yes, yeah. In those days, yeah. I remember once upon a time that they were a thing.
Yeah, no, he loved it. Yeah, it's brilliant.
Yeah, no, it was a pleasure to do it for you. And that's the point is we've done it for others since. And I think that it's actually a part of. I mean, you guys have waxed lyrical wonderfully about how, you know, the relationship between fans and players is so important. Not just fans and players, fans and club and players, and so on, and how vital it is. And it's actually been a pleasure to do them. And it's not we do it because, you know, we just want to hobnob with the stars. We want to do it to say, you know, thank you so much for all you've done, because it's like I say, it's not just turning out and scoring the goals and doing what it is you do. It's also about the sort of like the off pitch stuff and the appreciation that. You know, that you guys are clearly a sort of appreciating and knowing and receiving, but what you receive and what we can give aren't necessarily one and the same thing. And sometimes there's this kind of hinterland, this wall, this firewall that says, you know, are we on the same wavelength here?
And I think that's, you know, even Dunkey the other day, when it the awards day, you get a player's player of the year.
Yeah.
It means a lot more to you than it would
so.
Do if you got something from, because it's your peers. But
yeah.
Going to that, you know, something from the fans to you,
yeah.
You know, without obviously you sort of instigating anything, it's just an unbelievable award that you gave me. It was brilliant. I really, like I say, I really appreciated it.
Right, remind me, you both won player of the season, haven't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
twice, Danny.
So. As much as you're saying you'd prefer, I mean, if there was a player's player, you think, oh, this is great, thanks, guys. But, I mean, what does it mean to you then to win player of the season? Because you're saying, you know, the fans are appreciating what you're doing.
Well, me personally, that was the year, obviously, after that, where there were the problems when I first came. So to then get that the following season, it's people say, oh, you prove people wrong. I don't see it like that. I just feel it was just nice to get some sort of recognition for the fact that I've got my nut down, got on with it, you know, and provided the hard work. The lads were brilliant when all that stuff was going on, the eBay stuff, etc. I mean, you know me now. You know me for a number of years now. You know my humour. Obviously, I'm self sort of. I'm not mind laughing at myself.
Self-deprecating,
but that's,
I feel like.
But that's the way that I've sort of been brought up. And no one, even when I was a youngster, getting at first team at Tottenham, I had people around me, family, friends. I would never have got too big because I weren't in my character.
Mm.
But they were always there to have a little dig and have a pop and all that one in a jokey sort of way. And it's fine. That's the way I've been brought up. So when something like that happens, it's more people around you that get affected by it.
Mm.
I'm sort of like trying to put on a. I didn't put it on a brave front because it didn't really bother me that much. Mm. But it's obviously got to try and go over the top to people around you to make out that it doesn't affect you. Mm. But the lads were superb. I remember, like, they, you know, they all stuck together, all got round me and sort of supported me. And then, like you say, to win that the following season, you just look at it and think, I didn't think I had to prove anything to me. I knew myself that once I was fit and get playing to how I could do, I'd be all right. But it's just a case of, you don't want to go out there shouting that from the rooftops,
no.
Because you don't want to.
But it epitomises him as a man and as a player. You look at what he, you know, the hard work that he'd done. We was coming in at, say, 8 o'clock in the morning, and he'd be on the treadmill working his socks off before training. And because of the group we had, you look at it and it inspires you, and you think, fair play to him.
Mm.
Fair play. And but that goes to show the work ethic that he wanted to do. And it was vindicated, which, you know, we all knew he's a good player. He knows he's a good player. But when you miss a pre-season, it's hard.
Hmm.
It's really hard. But to have that endeavour to go and do that and then to come back, and it just shows you what sort of man he is.
Yeah.
Because it's not easy to do that sort of hard work before training. And the training that we always had was very physical anyway.
Sure.
So you got two physical sessions.
Even that, I thought was a wind up when I was first started winning the gym. I'm looking around thinking Jeremy Beadle's going to jump out in a minute.
But he did it well.
But what was player of the season like? The accolade line for you then, Dan?
Yeah, it's just, you know, you only think about it on the night, really.
Right.
When you're going up, you don't think you go through the season thinking, I want to be player of the season. You go through the season wanting to do well.
Of course, you do best you can.
And on the night when it comes out, you know, you kind of downplay it because you might be player of the season, but you've had to have another 10, 12, 13, 14 lads that have contributed every game.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's, I know it's a cliche that it is a team.
Player's player award is actually along the lines of, well, actually, they do appreciate more than, you know, this isn't just about you know, the lads, this is them appreciating me. So, I mean, probably a player's player award, actually. Probably, I mean, would it have been divisive back in your day, or did you think that, you know, to have that would have been a good idea?
To be honest with you, I wouldn't have been either way. I wouldn't have thought it's, oh, that's divisive. Or it's, if I was asked to vote, I'd have just voted. Yeah. And I'd have voted clearly who I thought it was.
And going back to, like Danny said, like the you know, the awards that me and Danny got a couple of years ago for the community
we'll
stuff.
Talk about them in a minute, yeah.
Sorry to jump ahead, but no, you know, you couldn't have found like two people that probably didn't want to be there. It's like, you know, that's not what we do it for.
Yeah.
It's, and like Danny said, thoroughly deserved, you know, twice, I think it's just before I got there, but to win it twice on is just phenomenal. Mm. You know, it's just a massive achievement.
But talking about now being a community, you've been there for quite a while. You form quite a double act. I mean, for anyone that's ever seen you play, obviously, sort of like the good, aggressive, you know, teamwork players you are, it's kind of weird to see you walking around the stadium with clipboards and files and folders in your hands. It's quite a 180. But tell us what it is. How did you get involved in AITC in the first place? And you know, tell us what it is you do there these days.
Me personally, like you say, finished playing in 2008. So I'd always remember, I think it was the year before, when I got offered a year contract, I had a meeting with Dean Wilkins and Dick Knight over at the racket club when they were offering me the contract. I remember coming with my wife, partner, and we were sat there having a chat.
Are they the same person?
Sort of, yeah. Okay. I call her my wife, but yeah. So, yeah, we was having the chat. And,
Danny, stop it.
Yeah, and but I hope you don't listen to this. And so we were having the chat, and basically Dick's said, that work, you know, the ethic of the Brighton, the whole package and that, he wanted to replicate that in the community scheme. So he said it would always be there on the back burner. But like I say, I still had another year on. I just literally got offered another year contract, so we had to put it aside for a bit. But the day that I got released, I remember going to the Player of the Year awards up at, I think it was the Hilton or whatever, on the seafront, and going up to Dick at his table and just mentioning, you know, obviously, where do I go from here? And then Alan Sanders was in charge of the community scheme at the time, so, and Charlie was on the community scheme as well, so they had a sort of got together and had a chat. And yeah, I started working, I think it was about a month odd later or something like that, two months later.
What was your first gig then?
I worked, so, because I'm obviously Southampton based, I didn't realise how big Sussex was, and West Sussex, so Chichester, I was Chichester based.
Right.
Over there, it was, I think it was Hyde Martlett, one of the companies over there, they let us have one of their offices. One of their buildings at Chichester Gate. So I used to go over and do the after-school clubs, holiday courses, etc. in the schools, and just learn the ropes, basically, from a wonderful fella called Tony Clark. Brilliant at his job, absolutely superb with the kids. And he just showed me the ropes. Yes, I started then, but I was, like I said, I was still sort of playing non-league football for a couple of years then.
Yeah.
But, yeah, my day job then became Albion Community, and it's, yeah, got on.
But
got
you,
on
but this that. Is while you were sort of at Hamilton Waterlooville, while you were at Winchester City?
Yeah, Winchester, yeah.
So
yeah.
All these, there was kind of, you always had two jobs on the go.
Yeah, and then when I got to Eastleigh, I'd done a little bit there, assistant manager, and then it got to the K situation where they went full-time. So then obviously that's a, there's no brain, I was still working for the community scheme. So, yeah, it's a sort of, released that, and then I started working then on match days, doing a bit of lounge hosting at the games. So I never really got back into football. Don't really miss that side of it too much because
so
of the travelling.
10 years solid of AITC.
So
it's pretty much not that long after the that you went straight from.
Yeah, I think it was probably the season finished in May, say, and I think I'd end up working end of July or something like that, beginning of August.
Sure. So, Danny, how did you get involved?
I think mine was literally a year after, wasn't it? Literally a year after, I was living back. Funnily enough, I was playing for Gillingham as my last pro club,
right?
I'd moved back to Sussex, so I was doing that journey that all you fans used to have had to do every single day, and I was doing it in rush hour, Monday to Saturday, and at the end of that season, they offered me a contract, and I decided to turn it down because the travelling was kind of killing me, and I just moved my family back after being up, you know, moving up halfway up the M1 and back down the M1 and back to Sussex. So I decided, you know, at the time Kevin Keane had gone to Lewis, and I knew Kev really well. You know,
he was the former marketing manager at the Albion.
Yeah, he was lovely fella. but you know, they were in the conference. He was saying that what he wanted to do then, wanted me to help him out a little bit. So you know what? I thought 10 minutes from where I live.
Yeah,
you know, they're in the conference. I've been picking up a few injuries anyway, towards the
end. You saw that the writing was on the wall with your career?
No, I didn't. It wasn't that. It was more that I was picking up. I picked up a couple of little niggly injuries. I had a bad hamstring injury at Forest because I missed, like Guy was saying about missing pre-season. When I left Sheffield, I kind of knew at the end of that season. I'd gone on loan to Watford the season before.
Yeah.
So I'd finished the season at Watford and I had agreed a contract to sign for Watford that summer.
Right.
But Ray Lewinson got sacked. So A.D. Boothroyd come in.
All these things that kind of, at the beginning of the career.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, you know, I left there. Danny Webber and me had done a swap deal.
Yeah.
Danny went from Watford to Sheffield because Warnock liked to have about 10 strikers,
right,
as he probably still does.
Yeah.
Ray Lewinson, who I'd worked with, lovely man, at Brentford. He was in a relegation fight. He wanted me to come in and help him out, which I did. You know, we survived, but I didn't get the plan under Ray because he got sacked on the Monday before I signed. But because I'd already agreed, I said, well, I'm going to come anyway. Mm-hmm. The chairman put the contract in the bottom drawer. He said, obviously, you can't sign it, the full-time one, because we don't know who's going to be manager. AD come in, worked under him. He'd come from, I think, youth team football at the time or whatever, and the contract that I'd agree was a good one. And I think at the time he thought maybe he could get two or three players, younger players.
Mm.
But he actually reapproached me in the summer saying, can we sign? And I said, well, I've already agreed to go to Forest.
Right.
So anyway, in that interim, I'd kind of not play too many games pre-season at Sheffield because I didn't want to get injured.
Right.
So I was trying to keep my nose clean, not get involved too much, do running and whatever, but it's not the same when you're not doing the football side of it. So I went and signed for Gary Megson, who, again, really old school, really nice fella. You know where you stood with him. If you worked your socks off, you know, Yorkshireman, he liked you, and I got on really well with Gary. But I'd signed, I think, on the Thursday, and then I played the Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday.
Yeah.
And I'd done my hamstring in the third game,
ouch,
as you would in a week, because I haven't played since the previous season.
Mm.
And then I was out for a bit, and because I was too honest, really. I rushed myself back.
Right.
And I come back and I'd redone my hamstring in the first game. Rushed myself back in because I was struggling, redone it again. So I'd done it three times in one season. And it kind of, I think that weakened my hamstring, which was what finally finished my career at Lewis. I detached it. But that was because of the weakness in it. But it was that, because I really liked Gary, that Forest was a big club. I shouldn't have done the comebacks too quickly. I should have waited a little bit longer, but I didn't. So it kind of gave me a little bit of a weakness going forward. So that was kind of why I thought, I don't really want to be travelling around to Gillingham every time. If I pick up an injury, it's going to be a blooming nightmare.
Yeah.
I'd rather be back at home, spend more time with my kids, work with Kev. And it was only on a part-time basis at Lewis, so they trained two nights a week, which allowed me to go and do the stuff that Dick Allen had put in place in a community scheme, work alongside like Guy, Chippy, and Charlie, so you had your old mates back again.
So when you did originally join, I mean, what was your role then? I mean, what were you asked to do?
Well, a bit of everything, like say holiday courses. We've done a lot of stuff with homeless shelters. We've done, you know, a thing called Personal Best. We've done a lot of, we went to City College. We was in City College mentoring kids four days a week. And I also was doing Worthing College along for the Albion and the community. We was out, like Guy was outposted to Chichester doing coaching there. Charlie was at Basvic.
Mm-hmm.
Chippy was at City College. I was at Worthing College. So he was doing four mornings a week plus the training games on the Wednesday, plus the afternoon stuff doing the mentoring. So it's kind of, and then we just to get us to know what the community scheme was all about, until you go behind the scenes, you don't really, as players, we used to get involved in stuff. Hmm. You don't really know how vast and how many people they touch and how many different areas they touch until you actually go behind the scenes and see the nuts and bolts of it. And that kind of inspired us, and we're lucky that we stayed on, and we're also lucky that as an organisation, there's loads of different facets to it, so you can work with the BTEC, which is the department that Guy and myself.
What is it you're doing at the moment then?
Well, we predominantly work along the 16 to 19, which is kind of hot education that the kids have to do when they leave senior school. So when they do their GCSEs, by law now you have to go and do 2 years extra, whether it's college or a sixth form. So we basically do a sixth form here. So they're kind of like full-time scholars, if you like. They do training in the morning, education in the morning, or training, depends which way around you're doing it, and then training, education in the afternoon. You know, one year we've done training in the morning, education afternoon. One year we've done education in the morning, training in the afternoon. It just depends when the venues are available. So it's half and half, and then we take teams on Wednesdays and Fridays against other community schemes. So we do that, but Guy and myself like to get involved in the fundraising stuff, working in the inclusion projects with Martin Schooley, working in the disability with, you know, Paul Brackley, and I've done a lot of work with JD. You know, Guy's done a lot of work with the Julie Hodder Cup stuff as well. So
so have you. I mean, wrecking wheelchairs and things like that.
Yeah.
To be fair,
Guy got me into that.
Well, to be fair, and I can actually say this with some confidence and some, you know, consideration. I have seen Danny play in a wheelchair, and he played wheelchair football pretty much in the same way he played regular football. I mean, he destroyed. It's fair to say that it was like a demolition derby, wasn't it?
Well, I think you got to treat every game as if you want to win it.
Yeah.
And I did, no matter what you're doing.
Yeah, but these people are already broken.
No, I didn't do it against the kids that were in the chairs.
Right.
You know,
when
it was able-bodied against able-bodied, if you like, you know, because what we did, you play against the guys that have the, you know, the disabilities, and they are absolutely unbelievable.
Well, the power chair stuff, well,
they're unbelievable.
One of them actually played, you know, last year, Matt played in the World Cup for England in the power chair football.
They're so talented.
Yes.
And quick thinking, you know, we get beaten every time. But what we like to do, we like to bring, say, the Amex people in and other able-bodied people to show them the experience and show them how you know, sport and wheelchair football can bring everyone together.
It's so difficult. It is actually really difficult.
And it's competitive.
Absolutely.
And when you play against...
I've had to go in those power chairs. You can't steer them.
No, but when you play against a kid, you don't get nowhere near them.
No.
They're just too good for you.
Yeah, bang, bang,
they're
bang.
They're too good for you. So then when you play against, you know, able-bodied against able-bodied, you know, you get a little bit competitive.
Yes.
Because you can get closer to the ball. Like I say, when you play against the kids that play it regularly, you can't get nowhere near them because they're so good.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's for those who haven't watched it, I mean, you just think, it's just like nudging, like, you know, sort of big bumper cars or anything like that. No, they flip these things like a pimple, don't they?
Their brains are so sharp. They're so sharp.
And like I say, in Matt Francis, we have someone who's so good, like I say, he's turned out for England in the World Cup, and I think intends to go to the next World Cup in Australia in a couple of years' time. Yeah. So
I mean, and like I say, with JD as well, you know, the man's an inspiration, what he does. I've done some work with him recently on his challenge.
Yes.
And, you know, he just epitomises this football club. The hard work, the never give up, the determination. And what he's done is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. So tell us about... So I don't suppose there is an average working day, but like I say, when I've been to the stadium, just sort of wandering around, you know, free as a bird without any security, and I run into you two. Like I say, you are carrying files and folders and clipboards and what have you. So tell us about your sort of working day, your working relationship.
Well, my, say, typical Monday could be at the training ground. Well, sorry, turn up at the ground at the Amex, pick the boys up in the minibus, probably about 8:30, get them down to the training ground for a 9 o'clock start. We train there for 2 hours.
Who's the boys?
Well, the BTEC boys that are doing extended diploma in sport, it's called.
Right.
So I think it's equivalent of 4 A-levels.
Okay.
So we get them down to the training ground, train them for 2 hours, pack up, get everything sorted there. And then by the time we get back to the ground... have a little tiny little bit of lunch. It's probably about 12 o'clock-ish, little bit of lunch. After that, then we're up in the classrooms with them, mentoring them for 1 or 2 hours, and then we're off down to see the fundraising department, and then we're obviously arranging different things, trying to get people involved in the bike ride, or it could be the Julie Otter Cup, could be a number of things. We've also done, like Danny said, stuff for health department, depending on what's on that day. And then we're obviously planning for the next day's session as well. And also we have games on Wednesdays and Fridays, so we've got to make sure that everyone's available for that. All the logistics that go into that, which is basically sorting out the kits, make sure the minibuses are all right.
Arranging the fixtures.
Referees. Everything. Yeah.
Meetings we do. We go into schools. Doing a lot at the moment going into schools. We have been. We had some good funding going into schools to showcase the futsal that I run with Chris Day.
Okay.
Which is basically inside football, if you like, small-sided, 5v5, smaller, heavier balls, you know, really prevalent in Spain, Barcelona, Brazil, you know, Messi.
Didn't you have a tournament earlier this week?
Yeah, we've had a tournament. Three of my boys played in the All-Stars national team. Mm-hmm. One of them, Harvey Day, was top scorer. But it's a sport that, you know, is really getting pushed by the FA at the moment and a lot of the Football League. It helps you deal with the ball under pressure. The balls are smaller and heavier, so they don't really bounce, which might encourage you to keep it on the floor. Tight areas, you know, so you've got to be spatial awareness, dealing with a ball under pressure. Also, the transition from attacking to defending is very, very quick. You could have a shot, miss it. Within 3 seconds, you could be getting a ball like it back in your net.
Yeah.
But the biggest thing, I think, with a futsal, and what is really good, if we can keep getting it into the schools and get the funding to do it, is to deal with disappointment. Getting kids to be able
social
to deal
with... Social life skills.
Yeah, but you do it in a sport because futsal is a sport where you're always going to give the ball away because it's so high tempo. You're always going to make mistakes. But if you can get the kids to tune their minds and say, hey, mistakes are okay. Everyone makes mistakes. But what you're looking for is a positive reaction from a mistake. That's what you're after. So you might have had a shot, but it's missed. But you can't think about the miss. You then got to get your defensive shape back because it's not like 11 aside where it's a, oh, they go and get it from behind the goal, they spot it down. No, the ball comes straight back on again. So you go from attack to defence, defence to attack. So you don't get time to have that disappointment. And that's, I think that's a good thing for the kids of today anyway, in all walks of life, is dealing... dealing positively with disappointment or giving the ball away. We tell them the best players in the world give the ball away, but what's their reaction? They want the ball again.
Sure.
They don't let it affect them. So if you can get the kids in a sport to understand, hey, do you know what? Making a mistake, don't crumble.
That's what life's about.
That is life. It's about resilience, digging in. If you digging in, going again, wanting the ball again. And if you make another mistake, so what? Because what you find with kids and with players is they get fixated on themselves. They think, I've given the ball away again. I've given the ball away again.
Failure,
but what they don't realise is there's another 9 players on that court doing exactly the same. Exactly the same. All around the country. But it's dealing with that disappointment and saying, do you know what? Actually, I made a mistake, but I'm going to have a positive reaction to that mistake.
Treating triumph and disaster, treat those two imposters the same.
Exactly.
And then after all that he's done, by the time I get home to Southampton, I introduce myself to the missus in case she
recognises me. Is that the wife or the partner?
Both of them.
Okay, yeah.
And so she don't recognise me, and the dog barks me, thinks I'm a burglar.
Yeah.
So
I'll be well,
then he has to start the oven in that again.
Yeah, sit in the washing
then
up.
Then I'm back out again. Make sure I don't wake the milkman up, and then I'm out.
Hang on, the milkman was there during the day, wasn't it? No.
Yeah, he is.
Are you two cycling to Germany?
Yeah,
yes,
very good.
Tell us about that.
7th to the 10th of June.
Yeah.
Yeah, Brighton to Cologne.
And you're going to get wet?
To be honest...
I'd rather be wet than sunny.
Yeah. I've been out for a couple of practice rides with this weather that we've had just lately. Yeah, got a couple of punches.
Yeah.
But yeah, and the heat is horrendous. I've had to go out early in the morning. Even then, it sort of affects you a little bit. So, plenty of fluids taken on board.
But you're not cycling all the way from... I mean, obviously, you're taking the Eurotunnel, but
Brussels.
Starting Brussels.
Yeah.
So, how far is it from Brussels to Cologne, then?
140 miles.
So, that's what, over 2-3 days?
85 the first day, and I think 55 the next. You're going to count me up on my maths now,
aren't you? That sounds about right, yep.
But it's an inclusive thing for everyone. I'm doing it for the
first... My sister's taking part.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. But I'm doing it for the first time this year. Guy's done 3 now.
It's been my fourth.
This is Guy's fourth.
Yeah.
And I keep saying I've never got round to doing it. I'm doing it this year. But, you know, we're going to be at the back.
Is the hamstring going to be okay?
The hamstring, because it's closed. It's closed circuit exercise, so it's all right. There's no hyperextension, you see.
Okay.
All these technical words.
I've no idea.
No, nor have
just
I.
Just a leg.
But no, the hamstring will be all right. But yeah, so we're doing it. You know, we're not massive cyclers, but we're going to do it because we want to be raising money for the community scheme, all the good work that everyone does in the community. But also, it's that togetherness, getting fans to do it, having a chat with them. You know, don't think if you perceive yourself not to be a great cycler, because me and Guy are going to be at the back pushing everyone forward anyway.
of course.
So don't think
you're going to be out the front bombing it.
No, we want to be at the back. We're last line of defence, me and Guy. We like to be at the back looking forward. So
a good centre half.
Exactly. Seeing the picture in front of you.
Really does.
But if there's anyone that wants to do it, get yourselves on the community scheme website. And
this is a plea for my lovely sister who's doing this. Her name's Sarah Hallett. So if you see Sarah Hallett, she's got a Just Giving page. She's cycling from Brussels to Cologne. So if you see her page, please sponsor her and donate towards that. That'd be brilliant if you could.
The beauty of it is it caters for all abilities as well. So
yeah. So it's a hoot, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, to be fair, it sounds horrendous, 85 miles, but you have breaks, obviously, and stop for lunch, etc.
Think of those cold German beers at the
exactly.
end of it.
And that is it. And that is the key. What I found on it the last few times I've done it is in the evening, you get a good chance to socialise. And, you know, you can network, do whatever you want to do on it, really. Mm. It's there's no time limit on it. You know, you can finish first if you want, 3 hours ahead of everyone else, or you can just poodle in at the back. I've known people stop in villages and have something to eat or a nice little cold beer and carry on with the cycling. It's brilliant.
But there's all ends of the spectrum. Yeah. So if you're an enthusiastic, you know, one that wants to ride really quick, there's certainly guys and girls doing that. Or if you just want it, someone that thinks, oh, I can't do that. No, you can do it. Me and Guy are doing it.
Yeah.
You can be at the back with us. Yeah, you can be at the back with us and just having it as a social and enjoying. Make sure everyone's enjoying it.
So that's the 7th to the 10th of June.
Yep.
I assume that all spaces are taken by now anyway.
No,
there's still spaces. There's still spaces to go, I think.
For 5 to 10 more.
So if you want to do that, go to email fundraising@albionandcommunity.org.uk or call 01273 878246. We're running out of time here now, guys, so there's just one thing I do want to say is that, and you touched on it earlier, but and I know that you're humble enough that awards themselves are sort of like, you know, you appreciate that they're for other, you know, that they're for the work of the other people, but, you know, you did also get a community award from the club in 2016. I mean, to be recognised by the club for the work that you're doing. I mean, it's not just about, I suspect part of it is not just about the fact that the work you're doing, which was brilliant in its own right, but for the fact that, you know, you're working for the club, this club's working for you, and you know, the work you're doing for society as a whole is very much appreciated. So there must have been some satisfaction for you there to actually have picked up that award.
I think it's, you know, we sort of, personally, I think I collected it on behalf of the whole of the community scheme.
Sure.
Because everyone behind the scenes, you've just got to, you know, working there for a number of years now, you've just got to see how it runs, you know, and the amount of effort that goes into it by everyone, it's brilliant. And also, you know, it's a funny little story, really, that's a lie to me and Danny, really, to get us there, because they knew that we probably wouldn't want to turn up to collect,
so when
and
you,
to lie
you,
to us.
So when you did the film, and you did the interview, what were you told it was about?
I just thought that was for the kids, the basically introduction about the course that we do, that we run for the kids,
yeah.
And, you know, how well they're getting on, things like that. That's what I thought it was about.
We got told to come on the table. Could we come on the table, the community table for the night, because there's a guy that wants to donate some money, because I got asked to come to the do in the first place. I said, oh no, so not really my thing, you know. That's
so you were swizzed into it,
but only went because they said there's someone on there that wanted to meet Guy and myself and was going to donate some money. So I thought, do you know what, it's not really my cup of tea, but as it's going to get someone to donate to the community scheme, we'll go.
And going round full circle again,
yeah,
amongst the first people to congratulate us, Bobby Zamora, Steve Sidwell.
Sure,
yeah,
sure. Do you remember when the film was being done? Do you remember the music they put to it?
I can't remember the music, but I remember falling over on it.
Oh, right.
Tripping on the ball. That was quite funny.
Yes, that was that, yeah. No, it was 25 Miles by Edwin Starr. One of your favourites, surely.
Yeah, it must be. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Decent, the old Northern.
Absolutely. A bit of Motown there, yeah. right, like I said, we're getting near to the end of this. So, like I say, between you, 450 games for the Albion. You know, first appearances at the club were 20 years ago and sort of 15, 16 years ago. And all this time, the longevity, you stuck around, Guy, Danny, you came back. So you kind of covered it, I know. But just as a closing thought from you, what does Brighton Hove Albion, probably both in terms of playing and Albion community and the work and everything around it, what does it mean to you?
Me personally, it's I've made so many friends around the area. My missus says to me, you know, she even contemplated moving closer. And I think that's the only, you know, I sort of travel around trip 140 miles a day to come and work for the place. And that's the effect it's had on me. I love the area. I love the people. I love the football club. And I think, you know,
and doing radio shows.
Brilliant. Brilliant. And but yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's things like that. It's just the whole, everything is a whole around it, I think. And seeing the success that the club's had on the pitch as well, I think everything goes cap in hand with that. You know, and it's just brilliant for me.
Yeah, I'll echo them thoughts as well. And I'm just proud to be able to still represent Brighton Hove Albion, Albion in the community, and the whole community in Sussex, to be honest with you. It's a pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm proud to do it. You know, and I wear the badge with pride. You know, it's kind of embedded in us now. You know, we love the area. We love the fans. We still speak to all the fans all the time. The football club's different class. the people behind the scenes. You know, there's still a lot of that there when we was there.
Could you ever have envisaged all this when you first joined?
No.
20 years on. I mean, no one knows what their life's going to be like 20 years hence.
But that tells you how special we talked about the football club is, and the ethic and the camaraderie and the, you know, the togetherness, everything is there. And that's not just players. It's the fans. It's the people that work at the football club. It's the people you work with alongside, you go out and work for. You know, everyone you're walking around. And, you know, today, even walking down here, we got a coffee and we bumped into two Brighton fans that were saying, oh, hello, Danny, how are you? You know, even just walking along the street down here. And they were giving you the time, and we was giving them the time. And it's just, you know, it's nice, friendly. It's really nice.
Just that little tiny vignette of life, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Guy Butters, Danny Cullip, thank you very much indeed for coming on to the Albion Roar.
Pleasure.